Welcome to VetWatch at DVM360. Today's episode, the allergy test showdown, skin versus blood testing, and what to do after that. I'm thrilled to have my friend, Dr. Alice Droman, back with us again. And for those that do not know Dr. Droman, she's worked as a hospital pharmacist and is an experienced board-certified dermatologist who splits her time between Ohio and Florida. She hosts the Speaking of Pets on YouTube podcast and runs the website perfectpet.com. That's P-U-R-R spelling. Welcome, Alice.
Thanks, Dr. Lee. Great to see you again.
Oh, it's great to see you too. And thanks so much for coming back on the show.
I feel it's kind of like Monday night football when the helmets go like this, serum testing and intradermal skin testing.
I know it's a hot topic, and I can't wait to learn from you on this.
Oh, good. Well, I think you're going to be pleasantly surprised because a lot of the data show that you can still have your 60 to 70% success with immunotherapy, regardless of whether you serum test it or you skin test it. And I think that is a welcome fact for most general practitioners to know, because no one that I know in general practice is going to stock 70 to 80 different allergens and have them go outdated. So it's just not practical. But serum testing has come a long way. In my opinion, it all funnels down to the interpretation. Okay. You can't just take that paper and say, what are the highest positives, and throw that into the solution and expect to have success. You've got to, as I say, when the kids are all in bed and the office is closed and the office cat has been fed, take that those results, go over the history of that pet, be it a dog or cat, and make sure those serum test results, and this goes for skin testing too, match the time of the year the pet is affected. That's the whole key to it right there. And you really can have a good success rate. I mean, when they interviewed pet owners, would you do it again? Did it improve your pet's quality of life? 60% said absolutely. Now, did they enjoy the ear cleaning and the shampooing? No, complaints still filed in about that. And I don't blame them there. But really, I feel badly when general practitioners don't feel they're capable of doing this, because you are. I get it that it's a new world. It's one more thing to learn about. But once you do, or once you dedicate one of your employees, say one of your vet techs to this, it can be really a successful venture for that pet and that pet owner.
Now, am I oversimplifying things? But it seems to me that there's kind of two ways of thought for a lot of general practitioners. Those that say, I like doing the blood tests. If they want to go to a dermatologist, great, but maybe that is not an access for many of their clients. Sure. So they're doing in-house. And then you have another group that say, my dermatologist does not like the serum testing. We don't believe in it. So the only way to do is skin testing. Is that kind of the two groups of thoughts that you see?
I do. Except there's a subset of the dermatologists that say, quote unquote, gold standard for intradermal skin testing. And well, let's broach that first. After having a long career in pharmacy, I saw so many drugs that were the gold standard come and go. And I think you'd agree in veterinary medicine, you know, 15, 20 years ago, there were drugs that, oh, they're outstanding. And that's our standard. And now, not so much. So I like to refer to it as the current standard of care. Okay. And having said that, you can ask 10 veterinary dermatologists and get 10 different opinions. My personal opinion is I like to skin test and serum test, because I figure that gives me all the information I can get that I need to make up that allergy solution. It's not for me to make that diagnosis of atopy, that's for sure. We're going to talk about that. And again, the reason the gold standard is not skin testing or serum testing is you can have non-allergic pets skin test or serum test positive, and vice versa. You know,
that's one of the things I hear often is that mm-hmm. if non-allergic dogs or people. So if you do not have ADAPI, you could run a serum test and just pop up positive for a lot of things. And many times I hear that is the reason as to why they do not believe in that testing.
I gotcha. And that's also true for skin testing.
Okay.
Of course, why would I be skin testing a clinically negative patient for ADAPI, right? But in tests that have been done in the past for people publishing papers, you can have clinically normal, let's say dogs, and you skin test them and you get positives. There are reasons for that, but certainly it's kind of like Cushing's disease. If there's no symptoms for it, why am I going to treat it? You see what I'm saying? The other thing I wanted to tell you about IgE driven. You know, it's interesting because in people, when they're trying to diagnose ADAPI in people, this was a long time ago, they would do total IgE levels. And they would find that in children, those total IgA levels, if they were elevated, usually meant that kid's going to become atopic as it gets older. Well, they did that same test for dogs. Didn't pan out at all. They did IgE, total IgE levels in puppies, followed them out for 3 years, made no difference. Some of the atopic dogs had the same levels as the non-atopic. So IgE, even though we've isolated it in dogs and we have ways to go in cats, we still have a long way to go, long ways to go. That's why we can't use the serum or skin test to say your pet, your dog is atopic. You know, I'll get a client in that says, this is worst case scenario for all of us. I want to know what my dog's allergic to. Okay, got the dog on the table. I'm combing it. There's a couple of fleas there. Oh my gosh, Mrs. Jones, look, did you know your dog's a couple of fleas? Yeah, I know he's got some fleas. I want to know what he's allergic to. That, you know, that's a good hour right there because you've got to convince that owner, okay, we've got to resolve this flea problem, flea allergy first, and then there may be additional allergies. And yes, most atopic dogs are flea allergic. I'll give you that. But it's difficult for owners to understand that a couple of fleas could be causing all that same problem as, say, a ragweed allergy. I think because they compare it to us. They see how miserable ADAPI is in us, and we don't have fleas. So that must be what's wrong with the dog. Must be atopic.
So if you were going to put, again, serum testing versus skin testing still comes up top, but you utilizing both is also a great option.
Both or either.
Okay.
My advice for if you're going to serum test, we have three or four wonderful companies that will help you. Okay. I happen to use one particular one after I've tried all four. And all of them have their little idiosyncrasies, which you have to kind of gain as you progress in this. I happen to use Heska, but Greer Stahlogenase, Greer is fabulous. VARL is fabulous. A lot of my colleagues use that. The new PAX by Nexmune, that's wonderful too. But you've got to stick with one and get to know it. And then my other advice is get to know one of the veterinarians on staff that deals with immunotherapy and interpretation of these serum tests. I probably drove Dr. Lozano and Dr. Costello at Heska crazy for several years because they were instrumental in helping me with my area. I happen to live in Ohio. I do practice in Florida too. And actually, that's another advantage of the serum test, which you can test regionally for where these people are going to be living, or if they spend 6 months in Ohio and 6 months in Florida. I want to make sure, you know, I do live oak there in Florida, which I don't have live oak here in Ohio. But see, they can explain all that to you. And then you can talk to them about, okay, what are the most relevant positives that I need to put into an immunotherapy solution? That and interpreting what is relevant for that patient is really the key to success, as I mentioned earlier. But I do want to mention, as a rule of thumb for me, I usually never put more than 10 to 12 allergens in a vial, okay, in the immunotherapy vial. There are some studies that show it doesn't make a difference. You can put 20 in there, you can put four in there, and you're still going to have the same success rate. My other advice is you usually start out with what we call a 200 PNU, protein nitrogen unit solution. And then you progress into a 2000 PNU, then a 20,000. And you can go as high as 40,000. I've had several patients that I actually had to start at a 2 PNU solution because the very first injection, 0.1 cc of the 200 PNU solution, made them itchy. And if you don't know that, they're going to keep going. And then they, higher and higher each week. Well, I'm giving the shot and he's itchier for 3, 4 days after the shot. That says to me that dose is too high. So it's not rocket science. You just have to remember that you're giving them what they're allergic to. And especially, let's take ragweed. Ragweed is horrible here in Ohio right now. If I've got my dog on a ragweed allergy injection, and we'll talk about other methods of giving immunotherapy in a minute. And I give her the injection today, and she's itchy for the next 3 days. I'm going to call the allergist and say, hey, do I need to do something differently? I might skip a shot that next week and let things settle down. Or I might say, okay, did you give what, 0.5 this week? Let's give 0.25 next week and then report in to me. This is why you almost need, if you don't want to get involved as a veterinarian, you need a dedicated person in the office because it is very time consuming. But once you get them regulated, it's a home run.
That's great to know. So, really, when you're thinking about general practitioners wanting to do serum testing,
Yes.
it's not so much about whether it does or doesn't work. It does work for many patients, and you said 60, 70%.
Yes.
And so, a lot of it, though, is do they want to tackle what's going to be involved in it and that management? That's where the key is really going to.
You're absolutely right. The key is you've got to have the right client. You've got to have a client that's good at observing. You're not just going to go down this list, point one, point two, point three each week, and then they come in and plop down the solutions and the chart and say, this didn't work. Well, on our allergy chart, the instruction chart, we have them call us when they're going in from one vial to another. So the next vial is 10 times stronger. Okay. We want to know if that first shot of that next vial is makes this dog itchy. It takes observation. And there are people that travel for a living. There's a mom that's got five kids. I don't know that she's going to be able to observe this dog. You've got to have the right pet owner, and you've got to have the right pet that's amenable to getting an injection under the skin once. Well, our schedule was once a week. I have to tell you, I think cats do great. I've demonstrated how to give cat owners the shot. We use some normal saline, and we're talking, and they say to me, when are you going to give the shot? I'm like, oh, we already did it. Plus, think about this. I don't have to medicate that cat orally once, twice, or three times a day. And I think I told you this before, but we had a local policeman that had a cat. And when we were demonstrating how to give the shot 0.1 cc in a TB syringe, he started to pass out. And I love that my technician was grown up on a farm, and she's a tough number. She said, you carry a gun and you can't give this cat a shot. So that was, and but anyway, he brought the cat in every week and we gave the shot for him, and it was a no-brainer. But I've had 80-year-old arthritic-handed women be able to give their cat a shot once a week. And I'm telling you, I personally think, first of all, I love talking about catapy. I call it catapy. I think catapy cats actually do much better on immunotherapy than dogs do. And I still don't know why I say that. It's just clinical reference. But anyway, so we're doing this allergy shot once a week. It's the only way of treating atopy in the dog that you can actually cure the disease because you are inspiring tolerance. Yes, the cure rate is tiny. My technician's dog was cured. She forgot to renew it 3 years later. And I said, hey, how's Pretzel doing? Dog's name was Pretzel. It was so cute. It was a boxer, the reticulated pattern. And I said, how's Pretzel doing on the shots? Oh my God, I forgot to renew those. The dog did great, and she lived next to a reservoir, so it was a high moldy area. But anyway, once you get that dog under control and they're on maintenance, sure, they're going to flare. There's no 100% one treatment for atopy in the dog or cat that's going to hold them because Allergies dynamic. I'm looking outside right now and horrible ragweed. I can see it. I can see the pollen blowing around. So it's going to be worse days than others that we may need to reach for some supplemental oral meds. But really, when you look at it, immunotherapy is a biologic, it's not a drug. And I'll get weeds and seeds people in. I'm a weeds and seedser, okay? I'll get weeds and seeds people in. They don't want a drug. You know, I say to them, what could be more natural than giving your dog what they're allergic to and inspiring blocking antibodies and tolerance to that? So they kind of step back and think about that.
What would be the top allergens that you find on the blood test?
The top allergen for dogs, cats, and people is house dust mite.
Okay.
It lives in bedding, carpet, mattress, upholstery, unless you have a dog that lives outside. You know, I skin tested a clouded leopard at the Cleveland Zoo, and I thought this is going to be the real test of this gold standard skin test. This clouded leopard has lived outside its whole life. There's no bedding, carpet, mattress, upholstery in his cage. And if he tests positive to house dust mite, I'm just retiring right now. Okay. Luckily, he did not. But I'm sorry, it was a she because she was part of their breeding stock, which is sad because, as we all know, atopy is hereditary, which is comes from the word atopia, which means strange by the Greeks, and they named it that way because they saw the same disease in the same families of people, i.e., hereditary. But anyway, we put that clouded leopard on desensitization, and she did very well. But yes, dust mite is the number one allergen in dogs, cats, and people. And then I'd have to say, for example, here in Ohio, grasses and weeds are way up there. But it's kind of easy to predict with these dogs once you live in an area for a while. Ohio, trees are first to pollinate in the spring. So if I've got a spring flare up, okay, it's probably trees. Then grasses are next. We're just coming out of grass season here now. And now we're into ragweed season at least through October.
And that's why you said it's important to look at it with what's in bloom and timing. Does
Yes.
that also alter the time? I mean, most of the time, I would assume that clients are getting tested when the flare-up is worse, but that makes a big difference of when you do the test.
That's a tough one because serum IgE, depending on what papers you read, can last 2 to 3 days, 2 to 3 weeks. Whereas tissue associated IgE, i.e., adhere to the skin, which I'm skin testing for, can last a couple of months. So my preference is to test in the fall after this dog has been through a spring, summer, and fall allergy season. I don't like going too far like into late winter because then that IgE is going to be dissipating. And so the other thing is about age of testing. You know, one of the criteria for denoting atopy in a dog is they usually start at less than 3 years of age. And pruritus is the number one sign common to all. Okay. And they're usually steroid responsive, but that can get you down the rabbit hole. We'll address that in a minute. But if you've got, say, an 8-year-old dog that's itchy for the first time, you better look for an ectoparasite. You better look for early scabies. Thank God for the isoxazolines, which you and I have talked about before, because that's limiting the ectoparasites that we're seeing. But really, and I have to say, I think all of us are probably guilty of having a dog come in and thinking, oh God, I hope this dog isn't growing into allergy. And he's just itchy. That's the only sign. And I recheck in a month and I see that crusty ear edge. And I'm like, damn, that was scabies the whole time. But that was before the age of isoxazolines. The other thing about testing, let's get back to that for a minute. Okay, so I'll get a 6-month-old yellow lab in and I'll think, oh God, poor thing. I'm sure he's growing into atopy. I don't want to test him until he's been at least through that first year of allergens and maybe even repeat the second year. Okay, so if you test him under the age of one, you may not get that full picture. He's growing into his allergy. Oh, and one other
Yes.
thing I do want to tell you, speaking of yellow labs, I don't know why, it's an anecdotal observation. I've seen it from the dermatologist at Cornell too, so it's not just me being me crazy. For some reason, yellow labs can take up to 2 years to respond to allergy injections. I don't know why. I do think they're more sensitive to certain meds. They're kind of like the blonde-haired, blue-eyed child, if you will. But yeah, it can take up to 2 years for yellow labs. And I tell those people, hang in there because don't give up yet. It's only been a year and 4 months. But the majority of dogs, you'll see initial response in 2 to 5 months. But I like them to, the owners to stick with it for at least a year before we say, hey, it's not working. We certainly can do some Apoquel or Cytopoint or Cyclosporin or Zenrelia to keep the itch controllable while we're building them up on the shots. Or I actually shouldn't say building them up. I should say getting to the right dose, because it's important to tell them, listen, your goal is not to get through all these vials. Your goal is to get to whichever dose of whichever vial keeps your pet comfortable.
That all you bring up a good point. This also seems like client expectation is a very important part of this because I think some clients think, oh, we'll run the test, we'll find out what they're allergic to, and just get rid of that, and it'll be solved. And that is
I
probably
know.
not how that's going to work.
Well, that's where that's, you know, then that pet becomes the pet of the boy in the bubble. Except remember, there's bedding and upholstery there in that hospital bed. So he would be just my allergic. But no, you're absolutely right. When people come in and say to me, and you can, other dermatologists, you know, when we get together for cocktails, it's just like that, talking about this. They'll come in and say, I want to know what my dog's allergic to. And I say, I can do that. I can do that in the next 10 minutes. What are we going to do with that information? You can't avoid ragweed. You can't avoid dust mite. Oh, my house is new. There's no dust mite. Dust mite moves into a new house within 3 weeks. I don't care that you don't have carpet. You've got bedding. You're not sleeping on a bamboo cot, are you? Because it's in bedding, carpet, mattress, upholstery, and it comes out at night. It actually prefers to feed on the skin of atopic individuals. You know, our skin cells that exfoliate off. So yeah, we've all got dust mite. But the problem is it's not enough. It's not helping that dog or cat to know what they're allergic to. You've got to do something about it. And the only reason I will run the test is to put that dog on injectable immunotherapy, sublingual allergy drops, the new transdermal immunotherapy, or intralymphatic immunotherapy. So it's not enough to know what they're allergic to because you can't avoid it. I wish you could.
It would make it easier. Would make it easier. Now
Right.
you'd said that there was again that 30 to 40 that are not going to work with serum testing. For
Right.
the clinician running it, will they know it when they get the results back, or is it a trial and error that's going to lead to it? So again, client expectations.
Right. You're right. They'll know. You should start to see something within 6 months. Something as far as, okay, he doesn't have to use as much Apoquel, or he doesn't, the pet is maybe on steroid Monday, Wednesday, Friday, as opposed to every other day. So you're right. You do get a clue about 6 months into it. But you, again, that can be A, the owner isn't observant enough. Or you've gone past the point of, say, maybe in vial 2.4 was holding that dog and they went above that. And now every time he gets a shot, he's a little itchy. So we need to back off on that. I think in at least in my opinion, if you choose the atopic patient, which I know sounds elementary, but if you choose the right patient and you compare those results at the time of the year they're having the problem, and you get an observant owner, that's like check, check, check. You're going to have success with it. The biggest problem, and I've had it happen to me, is they plop down, like I said, the paper with the what they're allergic to with all the vials and say this didn't work. And there's the those top three reasons that I just mentioned are the reasons it didn't work. You've just got to make sure you've got an atopic patient, which I know sounds silly. But you might have a patient that has a yeast hypersensitivity, you know, and then you got to pull out the ketoconazole. And I've had yeast hypersensitivity patients. When I get an itchy dog in, and I can do this in 10 minutes, I rule out ectoparasites, I look for pyoderma. If it's all year round, meaning non-seasonal, we're going to look at food, okay? Because remember, dust mite can be all year round. So can a yeast hypersensitivity. And if I find a lot of yeast on this dog, if interdigitally in the ears, the ventral neck, I say, look it, let's do this. let's treat the yeast first and see how far we get. And if we treat the yeast and your dog is comfortable, we may just focus on that. But if we treat the yeast and they're only maybe 30, 40% better, I know I've got underlying allergy then.
And looking at yeast, how would we look at that? Is that going to be impression smears? What's
Yeah, we do ear cytologies and we
okay.
do. I have a little dental tool that we use, and you can use tape preps. You can use the edge of a Q-tip, and you just put a little bit of that of this seborrheic skin, for lack of a better word, on the slide. Diff quick it, and here's the deal though with yeast: people want a finite number. Oh, more than 10 or more than 5. No, it's per individual. I've had dog ears loaded with yeast. My own Golden, for example, I get a bunch of that out of there. It doesn't bother her at all. Yeah, I treat her. But if I find one or two yeast in that ear and it's flamingly red and they're going at it, that ear has worked up an allergic reaction to that yeast. So it's not like you have to find a dog loaded with yeast like you will on a basset hound. You can find a little poodle that has some ventral neck and interdigital yeast, and you treat them for it, and maybe you see one or two on the slide. To me, it's how itchy is this dog with what I'm finding on it. And of course, shampooing.
So again, prior to any GP running a serum test, they
Yes.
should be running, again, always be looking for ectoparasites, looking
Pyoderma.
for pyoderma and skin and ear cytology, looking for those that yeast hypersensitivity.
Because you're funneling it down
Okay.
to, I've ruled this out, this out, this out. Okay, what's left? Atopy. And for that, remember, pruritus is the number one clinical sign. Dog is usually less than 3 years of age, usually affects the ventral aspects of the feet, the ear, and the ventrum, because that's where they absorb the allergen across the skin. I always thought it was ridiculous that we called it inhalant allergy. And why are their feet affected if they're inhaling it? You know what I'm saying? So now that we know the main way to absorb, to get the allergen into the body in dogs and cats is across the skin, percutaneous absorption, it makes sense to me. Okay, he's walking and he's laying on what he's allergic to, be it grass or weeds or dust mite in a bed, and those areas are affected.
That
Big
brings
problem.
up another good point. Now, before
Yes.
we move into food allergy, talking about food impact to atopy and overall success, what do you feel about proper nutrition with omegas and antioxidants that help support success? Is that a big key?
Yes, at least I can, you know, they did one study where they fed a group of Labrador retrievers that were atopic. They fed them omega-3s, things like B6, inositol, choline, histidine, and those improved, 10 out of 33 improved their clinical symptoms versus the ones that had nothing like that in their diet, only 2 of 25 improved, placebo effect, if you will. So I love to put my atopic patients, especially dogs, because we all know cats with food, oh, but I love to put my atopic dogs on a diet that's high in omega-3s and that's, and I know people hate this word, but hypoallergenic.
Okay.
Meaning, well, my favorite is actually Blue Buffalo's HP, hydrolyzed salmon. I like the salmon. I like the omega-3s in there. I like the studies show that if the dog's fish allergic, it's not going to interfere with that diet. Like we know with some hydrolyzed chicken diets, they can be chicken allergic and they'll flare on a hydrolyzed chicken. So I like to kind of do everything non-drug that I can to help this atopic dog. The other study that was interesting was most of these omega-3 rich diets have actually more omega-3s per serving than you could give them in a fish oil capsule. And with the then result of soft stool diarrhea type thing. So if I have to give omega-3s, which I like to do in my atopics, I like to do it via a prescription hypoallergenic diet as opposed to a capsule, which then I have to work up to the dose that allegedly can be effective. And then they're having soft stool and everything else. But I do feel diet to me, remember Hippocrates said, let food be thy medicine. I am such a believer in that. You know, when you're standing in the grocery store and you see like just unhealthy people in front of you, and you see what they're buying. This is why you look like that, okay? Because you're drinking all this caffeine soda and everything else, and Doritos and everything else like that. Pet health to me, just like human health, it's really depends on what goes in. So yes, to answer your question, absolutely. And studies support that.
And utilizing probably certain diets versus having just generally telling clients get a limited or allergy diet and have them go to the store. Like you had mentioned one company, but I know others like Hill's, Royal
Oh
Canin,
yeah.
Purina, they all have those. And in fact,
Yes.
with Hill's, I used to work for them and they had changed their bagging to preserve the omegas because in order to get those high levels, they actually had a nitrogen flush the bag, so the first time you saw oxygen was when you opened the bag.
Yeah. That's so true. And you would probably agree with this. I also tell people buy the smallest quantities, because once you have that bag open for a while, even though most of these companies, like you said, do research on the coating inside there, and also I tell people, don't empty it into a plastic container. Do you see all of that stuff in there that you put the bag intact in the bag, in the plastic container, excuse me. There was something else I was going to mention to you about the food. We also have atopic-like dermatitis, where you have a cross-reactivity between food allergens and some pollens. And in people, they call that oral allergy syndrome. Now, that's been documented. There was a study in Japan where they saw that in dogs that were cedar tree allergic, they were also tomato allergic. There's things that cross-react, like house dust mite cross-reacts with shellfish, probably because of the chitin. I don't know. But there are things that cross-react, stone fruits with birch trees. So we know that's true in humans. And I find that so fascinating. And I thought, well, since we haven't really looked a lot at that in veterinary medicine, let's just eliminate that possibility by putting our atopics on a prescription hypoallergenic diet that's rich in fatty acids. And let's just eliminate that from occurring or being a possibility.
So moving on a bit to now food allergies, what is the best way to determine food allergy?
I wish it was easy. And again, they're plopping the blood test for food on your desk like it's the Bible. They've read every food label in the world to try to avoid these ingredients that allegedly the blood test for food said they were allergic to. And we know studies show the serum tests for foods are just not accurate. I will commend one of the serum companies. They actually have a statement that says the American College of Veterinary Dermatology does not believe serum testing for food is an accurate way of testing your dog for food. And yay, I'm glad they did that. I admire them for doing that. I wish they would eliminate the blood test for food totally. Again, people, when they have it on that paper, there's something about it that they want to just adhere to every bit of that. And then I have to tell them, A, that it's not valid. Sorry. One of my colleagues in dermatology sent in teddy bear hair for that to be analyzed, because there's hair, saliva, and serum tests for food, none of which are valid. And that came back that that teddy bear had quite a few food allergies. They also sent in tap water for the saliva test, and that was positive for a lot of allergies too. So I have to be the bad guy and say, I wish you wouldn't have spent your money on that. 80% of food labels, when you're reading them, of dog foods don't necessarily contain everything in them that is listed. And I just get a blank stare after that. And it's reality, though. Sadly, it's reality. I just ran into, I was helping out Southwest Florida Golden Retriever Rescue a few months ago, and I just ran into a person that now moved up to Ohio, and we ran into each other. He had his Goldens, and he said, remember when you were trying to tell me that that blood test that was run on my dog by their vet in Florida wasn't valid? Well, I started giving the dog the things that it said it was allergic to, and nothing happened. I said, yeah, you probably thought I was a crazy lunatic, but it's true. And I don't know why that point is really hard to get across to people. But I would rather see them spend their money on a good prescription diet trial than I would a lot of money, which it is, on the blood test for food.
So again, in summary on that, with blood tests for veterinarians that either currently do it, maybe are now after listening to you considering it or haven't done it and want to try it, blood tests, they can work very, very well for environmental allergies,
Yes.
but we need to set up the expectations that it's going to take at least 6 months for us to know if this is going to be maybe one of that 30, 40% failures. And for
Yes.
some patients, like your yellow labs, they can
Yeah.
be 2 years before
Right.
this works. But
Right.
when you get a report back on the serum, if it has anything to do with food, just ignore it. Because
And
that's,
don't run it. Don't run
don't run it. Yeah.
the food test because it is an extra expense. The other thing, when you do get that serum test result back and you say talk to one of the veterinarians that work for one of the serum companies for environmental allergy, then you've got to decide for this patient, do I want to do injections? Do I want to do sublingual drops? Do I want to do the new transdermal? Or, a veterinary dermatologist would probably do the intralymphatic or the rush immunotherapy. So we won't talk about that. But the few studies in veterinary medicine that have been done on the sublingual drops, and there haven't been too many, the one study that caught my eye was that of the 10 dogs they studied, within 6 months, they saw significant improvement in these dust mite allergic dogs. Also, and this I can my N of one for this, one of my black lab patients, he was on immunotherapy injections and he was okay. I wanted to see him a little bit better. And when the sublingual method came out, I said, look at one study shows that half of the dogs that didn't respond completely to the injections did well on sublingual. Do you want to switch them and let's see how we do? And he did great. So you just never know the genotype and phenotype of your atopic patient. And it's strictly dogs here because we've done more research in genotype and phenotyping atopic dogs than we have cats. You just never know which method they're going to respond to. Now, the transdermal's new. I've got my own dog on it. Annie's on it. It's made by a company called Alibre. And I think they're marketing it only, and I may be mistaken this, to veterinary dermatologists at this point. I got the impression the first quarter of next year they're going to reach out to general practitioners. She's only in her second vial, so I can't tell you, but it's like a little tube. You just turn the thing twice and you just apply the cream to the underside of the ear every day. So they've put in a topical cream what the dog is allergic to.
Any
That
risks to people getting it on them?
you I probably should wear gloves when I do that, but in a more the morning rush around here is pretty tough. So, I pull that ear out and it's a golden retriever. I mean, it's a big ear. We do that on the non-haired portion. Bingo, she's done. She's eating breakfast and I'm out of there. So I just love it because I think it's another alternative way to do immunotherapy. But again, it's every day. And if that fits that person's schedule, great. Sublingual drops are twice a day, which is interesting because in people, they are 3 times a day. And I'm not sure why well, probably for compliance is why we started using it in dogs at twice a day. Because, it's a lot, it's hard for people to space out 3 times a day anything, be it sublingual drops or
It's a
meds.
lot.
Yeah, it is. It is. But I want veterinarians to look at, you could do this injectably, you could do this orally, you can do this transdermally, whichever one works for that owner. And I would offer that to the owner. There's not a lot of literature yet on the transdermal, but we've got enough on the injections and the sublingual. And I'll say, look, we can do it orally, we can do it injectably. And I've had two cat owners that wanted to do sublingual drops twice a day. Imagine that.
Now, it would just seem on the surface of it that between sublingual and injectable, I know for me, I'd rather have sublingual.
Yeah.
So, is there, I mean, certainly offer it to the clients, but is there an advantage of the injectable over the sublingual?
Well, in the fact that it's tried and true, it's been around since, gosh, almost 100 years, really. And sublingual for humans has been around a while, but for dogs, probably since maybe 2016, I think the I think Doug DeBoer published some things when he was consultant for Heska. My only objective, and this is maybe you think it's petty, but I remember at one of the DER meetings, I was at the round table talking about sublingual immunotherapy. And my husband and I are both pharmacists. We just couldn't get the math to work out as far as PNUs per vial. And Heska would not give up the recipe because it was proprietary. They were working with the pharmacy at the time. And so I ended up buying my sublinguals for my patients from Heska because that's where all the original work was done. Well, at this round table, all these dermatologists are making up their own. And as a pharmacist, I was horrified by this. What are you putting in there? I said, of everyone here, I'm probably the most qualified to do that, and I'm not doing it. But anyway, apparently it's working for them, and that's great. I just wanted to be absolutely sure for my patients that I was doing the right thing. But you are right. When I would offer sublingual versus immunotherapy, sublingual, most of them would choose that. But I'll tell you, the people that had allergic kids, they elected to do the injections. And by the way,
Interesting.
food allergic children, the parents get it. They get that when you're dealing with a food allergic pet, they get they can't have any corned beef, chicken, soy, turkey, beef, the seven, eight things I used to say and hand give the handout for. I almost would love when the owner of the pet would say to me, "Oh yeah, my son's food allergic." Bingo, I know they're going to get it. So yeah, most people, grandma or grandpa comes over, gives them an Oreo, gives them a piece of cheese. You set them back 2 weeks, and that's really kind of sad. Allegedly, it can take 2 weeks to work the protein out of their system.
Wow.
Yeah, imagine that. And well, and if you think of it, when you talk to a food allergic person, I don't know why people, as we get older, all of a sudden they become shellfish allergic. They don't feel good for a couple of weeks.
Yeah, those antibodies hang out for a while.
As you said, they're single and ready to mingle in your ear, my short, which I thoroughly enjoyed, by the way. Everyone needs
Oh,
to
thank
tune
you.
in on that. That was great.
Now, another question on what about the dog that comes in and the owners go, oh, yeah, every few months or a few times a year just gets an ear infection, nothing else.
Okay.
Should we be working those up for underlying issues?
Well, the first thing we've got to do is do an ear smear. Please, we're scientists, people. We are scientists. Anyone could go onto a shelf and pick out an ear preparation, okay? But this is why we went to school. We need to find out what's in there. Do the ear smear. It takes 5 minutes. While you're talking to the owner, have the technician diff quick it. And even read it. Or if you don't feel comfortable with your tech reading it, you read it. So we can pick the proper medication for what's going on. And I know that sounds ridiculous, but that's where it all starts. This isn't shotgun. We need to, if it's yeast, we need to use an anti-yeast and an anti-inflammatory. Because remember, yeast and Pseudomonas move in when there's something going on in that canal. It's not a healthy canal. Okay, yeast loves warmth. They like dark and moisture. And so you're in there, and then the ear canal becomes hot because it's worked up a hypersensitivity to that yeast. So it's just you need steroid to calm that down. And being a purist, I remember when I was young and innocent, I thought, I'm not going to put any steroid in that ear. Oh, I'm just going to put in some miconazole and we'll get rid of it. Didn't touch it because you've got to take the inflammation down. Inflammation is the root of all evil. It's the thing that's going to create an abnormal ear canal, and then you're going to have an overgrowth of yeast or overgrowth of bacteria. Then, when that ear canal gets super abnormal, Pseudomonas loves an abnormal ear canal. So, yes, first thing, ear smear. Please, please, please do that.
Now, question on that,
Yes.
because I have heard both sides of the argument, and I'm big on ear swab cytologies.
Yes.
However, I have also talked to vets that go, why? All of the products that we have an antifungal, an antibiotic, a steroid in it, whether it's a once a day, a twice a day, or an extended duration.
Right.
I always pick the same thing. So I've stopped doing ear swab cytologies. I hear that as as often sometimes as I hear the every time we do ear swab cytology. So what do you say to those people that say, well, most all of the commercial preparations have all three in it?
Okay.
What say
Okay.
you?
So here's the pharmacist coming out in me. Drug reaction. I know everyone out there has seen, not that you've done it, but I've had animals referred to me on the first dose of a gentamicin-containing product. These dogs have lost their hearing. I've had it in bull mastiffs. I had it in my receptionist's little poodle mix. So if I don't need to use gentamicin, I don't want to use it. I don't want to expose a yeasty ear to gentamicin if I don't have it. Now, gentamicin does have some anti-yeast activity, but there's many more drugs that work much better. The azoles work much better against yeast than gentamicin. So that's my number one reason. Also, and just getting back to you doing your ear smear, also make sure you do an ear smear and put it in oil too, because an overtreated ear with steroid may be a Demodex ear. And that may be the only place on the body I had a pug in. We can't get this ear right. And I'm looking at all the meds, Otamax, Panilog, you name it, have been dumped in that ear. And I thought, wow, what the heck's going on? It was just one ear, which, by the way, food allergic dogs, you can have only one ear affected. You don't need to have both. We'll talk about underlying allergy in a minute. I
Those
go
dogs
in
just
there.
chew on one side of their mouth.
That's it. Yeah. And because they had facial paralysis on the other. But anyway, so had I not done, I did a regular ear smear and I had a second slide. I put a little oil in, had some discharge left on the Q-tip, rubbed it in there, put a cover slip on it. Bingo, Demodex. So then we stopped all the topical steroid because that topical steroid was feeding that Demodex. It loves immunosuppression. Okay, but let's talk about your original question. So if it's happening every few months, boy, that's tough because I would say, A, has it been properly treated? The biggest thing is you need to recheck those ears. There was a study published not too long ago that said one of the biggest reasons for ear treatment failures is the veterinarian's lack of rechecking that ear. Say I get a real hot Pseudomonas ear in. My goal, it probably started as yeast, okay? Little simple old yeast. My goal on that first appointment in the recheck, say in 2 weeks, in a phone call in a week, is to get that ear back to yeast. Because I know Pseudomonas set in because whatever was going on made that ear abnormal. So, okay, if I'm getting back to yeast and it's recurrent, I'm probably going to look at food, especially if it's non-seasonal, making sure I treated it appropriately. All right. I want to make sure it's not being overcleaned. Some of the ear cleaners, I know everyone says clean the ear, clean ear. How many dogs, when you walk in the room with the ear cleaner, run from you? I am not a big ear cleaner person. As a vet, I'll clean that ear. But as far as owners cleaning the ear, I would rather they not do it. I and my staff know how to do this. And I think the wetter you keep that ear, it's predisposing to yeast for one thing. And you're screwing up the normal migration of those epithelial cells. The ear is a self-cleaner. And you don't want to screw that up. So yes, I'm going to look if it's all year round. First of all, I want to make sure I've treated it correctly. Secondly, I'm probably going to look at food, food allergy, or I'm going to throw something else at you. Say I got one of these real greasy dogs, and they're just greasy like a basset, or I had a police dog in, just very very greasy, and so he's got yeast, and of course yeast in the flexural areas because when your skin folds it holds in warmth. I actually put him on a high fiber diet because I wanted to dry him out. Now, that's not published anywhere. That's just an anecdotal thing of my own, but it made sense to me. I love high omega-3s. Okay, omega-3 for itch, omega-6 skin and coat quality. If he gets too much omega-6, that can make him itchy. So at first, I had him on, the usual derm diet. Let's push the fatty acids. This dog came in greasier. I'm like, whoa, let's rethink this. So then I thought, I'm going to change gears totally. We put him onto a high fiber. It dried him up. It worked great for him. So I want people to think, even though we push the fatty acids for skin problems, think about it. If this guy's dripping and you can wring him out, there's some Yorkshire Terriers like that. You can literally wring them out. They're so greasy. And these poor women are carrying these stocks right up against them. God love them. They love them so much, or in the greasy purse. Let's get them onto some higher fiber and see if that kind of sucks up some of that excess seborrhea. But again, all year round, I'm looking at food, either high fiber or hypoallergenic prescription diet, always, or cooked if it's a little dog. And then if we get nowhere with that, say in 8 weeks, then we'll allergy test them. Probably if it's all year round, it's a dust mite issue. I've had some atopic black labs do very well on a single protein diet, like a venison and potato diet. Again, and when I think back, that owner had an allergic child, so she did that diet perfectly, and I loved her for that.
And also important to know what company is making those, because that's also one of those, as many of the companies will do PCR testing on their machinery before they run a limited.
Yes.
Whereas you go over the counter and it says, may say venison and potato, but it was run right after a beef and chicken diet, and so it is not pure.
I explain that to the owner. I say, look, you're going to pay a little more for these, but this is why. There's much more science going on in this diet. Like you said, they're PCR tested during and after. And how many, if that were true for this over-the-counter limited ingredient diet, of which 80% have other contaminating proteins in there, it would be the same cost as this prescription diet. That it, you know, food is such a hard message to convey because the marketing for food, it's so cutesy and cutesy rules. I have to, and sadly, it does. I know your podcast is full of information. Mine is too. My producers told me, you're too technical. People want infotainment. I said, I can do the info. I can't do the tainment. I don't want to do the tainment.
It's hard. Well, in some of the celebrity-backed ones, it looks like they're cooking it in their own kitchen. So.
Right. Yes, that's true. But anyway, yes, you're absolutely right. They think they're doing the same diet because it says limited ingredient. Oh, it's and the other thing is, and we're only going to do this quickly, the raw diet people, you can't use raw diet as an elimination diet to diagnose food allergy because I think the few studies of that show they were contaminated with other proteins. I think pork was the number one and turkey was second. So even though they're feeding raw, doesn't mean it's hypoallergenic.
That's a good point. That's a very good point. So again, coming back, if you have a dog that's getting recurrent ear infections, because a normal dog, right, should get zero to maybe one or two in their life. So if it's happening more than that, then we need to be looking for other underlying causes.
Yes, and no, yes, underlying causes. And I also like to keep those chronic ear infections, once we've discovered the underlying reason, I like to keep them on a little maintenance topical steroid in there, maybe a little Sinodic 2 days a week. Because, you know, there was one paper out that was fascinating. They did steroid topically only in a Pseudomonas ear. And do you know it actually outperformed some of what the culture for Pseudomonas said to use in that ear? So it
Wow.
goes to show you inflammation is playing a huge role, and not only in the ear, but in the pathogenesis of atopy in the dog and in people. We've got to, and we didn't talk about JAK inhibitors today, like Apoquel or Zenrelia or the new Numelvi that's going to be out in Europe. But we've got to keep down those cytokines that are causing all of this inflammation. And in the local area of the ear, once they've had chronic ear infections, that canal, in my opinion, is never the same. You've got to keep at it with a once or twice a week topical steroid. You don't have to necessarily have to have an antibiotic or an anti-yeast in there. Just a little bit of topical steroid. You could use HB101 to dry it out. You can use Sinodic. Some people use Cordastrin. Some people make up their own with dexamethasone. But the topical steroid keeps that inflammation down, and it will, you'll see, it will ward off any flare-ups that you're going to have, especially if they're atopic. Like now during ragweed season, it was 9.6 out of 10 today on ragweed here in Ohio. So
Wow.
everybody's suffering. Yeah.
So that's been so helpful. Is
I
there
hope.
anything else that you want to talk about with serum, skin testing, ear, ears?
Yeah, let's pretend we've got the patient. We've never met them before. They're coming in. They're itchy. They're 2.5 years of age, and it's a black lab. Let's just do the perfect picture. First thing I want to know, is it itchy? Yes. Okay. I'm going to look at it for ectoparasites. I'm talking to the owner because history is everything in derm. That's why telemedicine in derm is not going to work. You can't send me a picture. It's not 3D. I've got to see it. I've got to smell it. I've got to taste it. Okay. And as J George Carlin used to say about dog poop, thank God I didn't step in it. But anyway, but I've got to see this dog. I've got to smell this dog while I'm talking to the owner and getting the history. I'm combing for fleas. I'm combing for Chylotiella. I'm any abnormal areas I'm scraping or plucking. I'm ruling out ectoparasites. A number one. A number two, B number two, I'm looking for any pyoderma, be it bacterial or yeast. I want to clear that up first. Because if that's making this dog itchy, okay. Then if that starts to be recurrent, then I know there's something feeding that, food allergy or atopy. And then, of course, I want to stop the itch. I'm going to put him on a short-term, probably JAK inhibitor, because I don't want to do steroid if I've got a pyoderma. Remember, steroid makes anything look better. Takes that inflammation that's associated with that pyoderma, takes that inflammation away. But what did it do? It weakened that skin immunity. So I might look good in a week, but 3, 4 weeks go by, that pyoderma is raging back again because I've immunosuppressed that dog. And I don't care how low a dose of steroid you use, you don't know what the lowest dose for immunosuppression is in that patient. Just like Dr. Lee, you might be able to take 5 milligrams of pred for a bee sting. I take 5 milligrams of pred and I'm the meanest woman on the planet. Okay. You just never know how pred or steroid sensitive somebody is. So I'm going to stop the itch. I'm going to look for pyoderma. I'm going to make sure he's on a decent diet, make sure he's on a good flea and tick like an isoxazoline. And then once I've ruled all that out and got a good history, then I'll probably look at atopy or food allergy. Food allergy for sure if it's all year round and the ears are constant. But please don't forget, you can have atopy and food allergy together. And you can correct that atopy, but you got to do something with food. Because I still say, once you are heightened, your allergy response is heightened, you can react to anything, an inhalant that's environmental or a particular food that you're eating. So that's why I lap the two as one, because allergy is allergy. I don't care if it's a food or an inhalant. I can measure an inhalant or environmental. I just can't measure it in food. I got to do trial and error for that.
Love it. Thank you. That has been so informative.
And complicated, but you
It
know what?
is.
Complicatingly fascinating. And if we get together and talk about JAK inhibitors, I got to tell you, that just draws you in as far as how interesting that is. And I'm also very proud in veterinary medicine. The first JAK inhibitor came out in 2013 and in humans, 2021. So we won on that one.
Well,
Yay, for once.
thanks again for being on the show. Thank you all for watching VetWatch, only at DVM 360, where what you know today protects everybody tomorrow.